Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. So there's a new documentary out called American Valhalla that chronicles the pretty unique collaboration between Josh Homme of Queens and the Stone Age fame and Iggy Pop for Pop's album Post-Pop Depression. Rolling Stone's Corey Groh talked to Iggy recently about the film, the album, and the tour that followed. Hey, Corey.
Hey.
So the documentary is named after one of the tracks from the album, and how did the album come together?
What's interesting, because Iggy decided he wanted to make a new album, and then he decided who he wanted to collaborate with. And he had become a fan of Queens of the Stone Age over the years and decided to kind of pursue Josh Homme. And I think he'd first seen them on a festival in Europe, and they had to do like a photo shoot for one of the European magazines, and they were the only two that weren't dressed like, I think he said something like space monsters, because Marilyn Manson was part of it and Rob Zombie. And so he kind of bonded with Homme then, and then they kind of kept up, and then Iggy really liked the last Queens record, which was like Clockwork, and just the way that Josh showed that there was like so much of a depth to what this rock band could do, and he thought that that would be something that he could use on an Iggy record. And so he pursued him and kind of chased him down and convinced Josh to do this, which was kind of funny because Josh is a huge Iggy fan.
Right. It was more like Josh psyching himself up to believe that he could do this, which is interesting because Josh is a pretty confident guy usually. Mm-hmm. The documentary also shows how much thought Josh was putting into trying to find a sound that worked with Iggy. And I think it becomes clear why the album isn't just sort of like a hard rock stomping album. If anything, it's more like Iggy's Berlin period. And in the track American Valhalla, you kind of get the sense of what they're going for, which is like a much more atmospheric, much more sort of 70s Iggy thing. Let's hear a little bit of that song.
I have no plans, I have no debts.
And now we'll hear Corey Groh talking to Iggy Pop about making the album Post-Pop Depression and the documentary that followed, which is called American Valhalla.
Why did you want to document this album?
Josh wanted to do it. I just cooperated. It was all Josh's idea. So it was just, there it was. We were doing it, and then at some point we were doing it about doing it. If you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Which was all right with me, you know.
Mm-hmm. When you...
So
when
it's,
you
it's a compliment on his part.
Yeah, obviously he had a blast doing it.
Yep, me too.
I mean, does this album stand out to you when you look back on it? Does it feel different from other albums you made or more special?
I'm singing more. And the range of expression and also just the vocal range is wider. You know, that said, I'm aware I'm not Caruso. But, you know, or even, I don't know, who's the guy all the moms love now? I care. Michael Bublé. You know, not even. But that's one difference, and there was a range of, There was a big range of style on it, and I never ever expected going into this for it to be a rock record. Although there's enough of that in each of us that it, you know, it rocks a bit anyway. But it's more feeling music to me, but it has an awfully nice groove. So. I put a lot into it. You know, we lived it. I hadn't really lived a record like that since, American Caesar.
Wow.
But mostly all my albums in the 60s and 70s were more like a communal experience where you're living the whole thing.
How did that come together with this one? I mean, you see it a little bit in the film with everybody, you know, spending more time in the studio and with, you know, the campfires and stuff like that. Like, when did you feel that kind of communal experience this time?
Well, you know, Josh sent me at the very last possible minute, sent me a couple of just single note xylophone and guitar demos with him accompanying himself on drums, just of two of the ideas, the one on that became American Valhalla and Break Into Your Heart. And right away, the two of us kind of got hyperactive, and we started, there was a lot of texting back and forth about ideas that led to the lyrics. He called the one that was American Valhalla, just sounded real fresh to me. I didn't know what he might come up with. I'd heard the Desert Island, or I'm sorry, the Desert Session discs, and I liked all of them a lot. And there's a big range on that. There's everything from you know, blues rock to comedy to sort of reproed English art rock on there. And so he sent me these two, and I thought, oh, those are very creative. And the one with the xylophone, he called it Romans. But he knew in advance of that I'm a kind of a fan. I'm a little bit of a Roman history buff and a fan of the Empire.
Mm-hmm.
So we were throwing that around, and then he wrote me a text about his ideas about Valhalla and the fact that you had to fight to get in, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And then I wrote him back about, well, that begs the question, is there an American Valhalla? If so, where? Is it nice? How do you get in? That sort of thing. So that was before I even got out there. We were already back and forth. And on the other one, he had titled Break Into Your Heart. I could tell I could hear how that was going to go with the guitar lick. And that was one of those situations that happens sometimes where you work with somebody sends you an instrumental piece, but in their head, there's a corresponding lyric, and that's just what it is. There's no use fighting City Hall at that point. Mm-hmm. That's it. It happened, you know. So on that one, I kept trying to work around it, and he kept bringing me back to the melody. And I had never really tried singing a melody at that vocal range before. I tried it. I was trying to talk around it for a while, then I tried it an octave down, and he said, oh, just sing it up there, motherfucker. I said, all right. I took a deep breath, and here goes in front of all the lads, you know, and it sounded good. And sounds better by the time I'd sung that way for a few months on the live version. So I wanted a lot of input lyrically from anybody, and especially from him. But on the other hand, you have to sing. What you sing has to be true to yourself, too. So there was a lot of tailoring that went on. I think some people think of me as more a break into your heart guy, but I'm actually more of a crawl under your skin dude. So
I like that.
So, you know, yeah. So that there were those sorts of things to, you know, to take into account. And once I got out west, you know, I just said, look, he said, I'll pick you up at the airport. And I said, no, don't do that. And that's because I knew he'd be fucking late, you know. So.
Corey, in the next segment we're about to hear, you talk to Iggy about this song, The Pure and the Damned, which is actually from another project. It's a collaboration that Iggy did with 103.Never. Can you tell tell me a little bit about that song and that act that Iggy collaborated with?
Yeah, well, 10 Tricks Point Never is an electronic artist, usually does experimental music. This is a little more straightforward song. It's a piano ballad, and he just needed an Iggy-like voice. As as Iggy says in the interview, I think that he'd kind of gotten turned, or 10 Tricks had kind of gotten turned on to Iggy through a Danger Mouse collaboration he'd done for another film. And Iggy,
we all got into Iggy Pop through the Danger Mouse collaboration.
Yeah, and Iggy's just been doing all these weird things lately since he put out that record. Like, he did a jazz thing with Jamie Saft, and like, he did that. And I think he's just trying a little bit of everything right now, and it's cool.
So let's hear a little bit of that 10 Tricks Point Never song that Iggy Pop did with them. Actually pretty cool. It's like it sounds like a Iggy Brian Eno collaboration or something. It's like Iggy singing over one of Brian Eno's ambient albums.
Totally.
Anyway, so now we're going to hear another segment of Corey Groh's interview with Iggy Pop, and in this next segment Iggy starts out talking about how he showed up at Josh Homme's house to begin work on the album Post Pop Depression.
Basically, I showed up with a bag on his doorstep, and we just got in the Camaro and went out there, and I'm one of these people, you might have gathered if you ever seen me work, like, as soon as I start, I want to get it all done now. So, because is this going to be any good or not, or what the fuck is this? So we drove a couple hours out there, and we just walked straight into the little living room of that little place, and I had a bag of words, and he had it. Lot of ideas, and he just started throwing them at me on acoustic and electric guitar, one after another, and we sort of knocked together the beginning of about five things right there.
Wow.
And it sort of, it sort of just went like that after that, you know. And then, you know, as the guys come in, they hadn't told me this, but they'd done a little rehearsal of some of the themes on their own. So we were able to jam around a little, but mostly once you begin to come to grips with, okay, which song are we doing and which part of it are we doing first and how do we get this sound right and all that, then everything slows down a lot. And you just knock it out a song or two a day, basically, and that's the way it went. And for my part at that point, they would play the thing partially or well or not as well at first, maybe about 20 times, or working it out about 20 times a day for each piece, I would say, on an average. And I would just sit there and sing on every take so that I got to know it better and gave me a chance to cross out words and edit melodies, and that's what I was up to. Matt Helders was lurking around taking pictures at the time, and I didn't really realize just how good they were. And that was a real, that was a wonderful thing, what he did. And because he documented, you know, actual fun moments, you know, and or even thoughtful uh-huh. moments too, but he spied on me, basically. I didn't know I was being photographed, you know. And then the day Andreas came out was a good session, and it wasn't like a regular photo session. I mean, I didn't wash my face or anything. Uh-huh. You know, we'd just been in the studio all day, and he came and we took a break and drove out to a very sort of strange old abandoned art installation that's out there in Joshua Tree. There are a lot of beautiful, sort of abandoned, wonderful ideas out in that place. There's a sort of magic house from the future, and there's a wonderful building built by a disciple of Tesla's out there. And we did all the things, you know, that you do in the desert, like, what do they call it now? It's popular. They have it in Beverly Hills and in Manhattan, too. You lay on the floor and somebody bangs on
it goes boom. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know.
I'm being very articulate. It's the sonic healing. They bang on a bunch of kettles or something, and they go boom, like sound bowls. Do you know about that?
Kind of sounds like tonal therapy, maybe, something like that.
Yeah, right. We did some tonal therapy. It's big in Silver Lake, you know, now. So,
yeah.
You know. So it was pretty much just living it and feeling the pressure you do when there's absolutely nothing going on in your life besides that, to just feeling the pressure to try to make it really good, you know.
You said you were kind of surprised that it was a rock record. Why do you say that?
Well, because, look, it was like this. I've done these things before. Generally, when I collaborate with somebody, I don't expect them to bring what they're already good at, what they do really well and don't need me for anyway, to sort of as some sort of free pass for me to, I'll sing on it this time. No, you know. So that's, Queens is a hard rocking group, but I heard on his last record, I heard this ballad master coming out, you know?
Yeah.
And on the stuff like Clockwork, that was the stuff that really floored me on the last record, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I was like, geez, he can do that, you know? And I didn't really expect that he was going to, he can keep his rock stuff for himself. He earned that. You earn your rock spurs the hard way. It's a really dirty business. You know, yeah, people die, people get hurt, all sorts of terrible rip-offs and misunderstandings and challenges, and boy, you name it. And so that's, I don't expect anybody to hand me that. So I knew we'd do something just different. I didn't know what it would be. And then once I heard the first two little bits he gave me, I thought, oh, it's going to be kind of, I don't know, kind of like Chelsea Girls or something. you know what I mean? That's what I always go, oh, it's going to be like Sunday morning, you know. Yeah. But there was a little more to it than that, and he likes to, he kind of got into this kind of mid-tempo swagger on the stuff, you know. And had it all ended up with a really nice groove.
You know, it seemed from the film that you kind of had to pursue Josh a little bit as a collaborator. What is it you look for in a collaborator? What is it that you knew that he would be perfect to work with?
You know, it can be different given the occasion and what it is I want to do.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to do something fresh for me, but I wanted it to be something that could and would communicate to the sort of to the appropriate, to the applicable current music audience. That's a very particular thing for each sort of artist, and he is a valid current musician that, you know, people listen to. And so that was important to me. And then basically the taste and articulation and that I heard from the desert sessions that he's kind of open for anything. I mean, if you've ever heard Shepherd's Pie, it's basically a, you know, sort of a ragtime comedy track, you know. You say, oh, all right. So that was kind of it in advance. I just thought, well, this guy's intelligent, and I knew he'd listened to what I'd done already with some degree of interest, so I thought, just give it a whirl. That was it, basically. You know, sometimes I haven't had the easiest time anyone getting along in on the business side of things. So after a while, you start to feel like the whole thing it takes on, oh, here we go, cynicism time again, you know? And then it was refreshing to see, wow, there are a lot of people who really respect and appreciate what this guy's doing. So, you know, it's feeling. That's the one word, ultimately, that's what's really, really important, is the feeling. And then the rest of it, you get into, that's execution, and that's really necessary, too. But guy has feelings.
Why was it you didn't want to tour on this? Because I know you've been playing gigs this year. I know you've been
because I've been touring a lot, dude. That's why. It's hard, bloody work, and I just hadn't thought about doing that, you know?
Uh-huh.
I had thought, oh, I'll just do this as what it is, and then I'll go out and just do the what I do is a measured amount of touring anyway in a way that's sustainable for me at my vintage. Mm-hmm. and that's great for me, and I think I do a good job of it. I'm proud of it, but geez, do I want to go out with this? I mean, he's a force, Josh. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a handful. So it's like, do I want to go out with this maniac and actually put boots on the ground and play theaters? And, you know, what if, you know, and have a production and everything? And I'm so glad I did.
Yeah.
So glad I did. Because it was a one-in-a-lifetime result for me.
Yeah.
Both to bring that repertoire forward and to get clean, washed up and dressed nicely and, you know, well staged in a dynamic way, and to play beautiful places where, you know, there's actually a toilet seat on the toilet in the dressing rooms, you know, that sort of thing. You know, we had a kind of a thing between us. I think it came from something he heard in a couple of my vocals on things, something like especially mass production, a certain way I was singing that he took to be like opera. So he would put his hand aloft like a kind of a Siegfried in the ring, and he would say, "We've got to keep it up there, keep it up there." You know, it's opera, you know. I'm actually talking to somebody about, I'm threatening to do some opera in a couple of years.
Wow.
Yeah, why not?
That's awesome. Do you have favorite operas? Is there stuff you like to listen to?
Well, you know, I really like Tristan and mm-hmm. Iseult is maybe a really, really big favorite for me.
It seems like you've been doing a lot of different things lately, just trying to do, like I know you did some jazz and you did something with 10 Tricks Point Never. It seems like you're kind of just trying to do everything right now. Like all.
You know, it's just what happened is part of it, just people called. Mm-hmm. I'm approachable. Gosh, some of it came like I did the 10 Tricks Point Never. I would suspect was probably kick-started by the Gold theme song I did with Danger Mouse, mm-hmm. the Matthew McConaughey vehicle, Gold, mm-hmm. and which was like a last-minute job. They were desperate for a vocal, and I had 2 days off on a tour break, and I said, all right. But Danger Mouse had heard a song called I Want to Go to the Beach, which is on Preliminaire, which is one of these little quiet Frenchette mm-hmm. albums I was making when I could scrape time away from the original Stooges. So he knew what I could do. He said, I want you to sing. I've got a song. I want you to sing it the way you sang such and such. And then when that came out, it got a bit of attention, and I started getting calls I've done three since then, and the 10 Tricks has come out. I think it's like, you know, if you've got a Disney movie, you can call Elton John, but if you're indie, I'm available. And the 10 Tricks was just such a wonderful piece of music. So really, when somebody asks you, and it was the same with the Jamie and Steve and Bobby, the New Standard album.
Yeah.
The music, they sent me three tracks, and it came through an old friend named Bill Laswell, who's mm-hmm. like kind of a jazz bow, kind of not, you know, and a really interesting producer, and I like Bill, so I keep in touch with him, and I've done things over the years, like I did a Buckethead thing for him, and I did a Burroughs thing just because I like him, mm-hmm. so... He sent me word that these guys were looking for me, and they were. That's all he said was, you know, some
good musicians. It's not the usual thing. And, what do you think? And I said, well, send it to me. I'll listen to it. I thought, oh, wow, you know, I'd really love to try to sing to all three of these. And it was late in the year. I wasn't doing anything else. They didn't rush me. So that's why I did it. It was just a chance to try something a little softer in attack and more exacting in approach. Although the vocals aren't a very exact, I'm afraid. But I tried.
Yeah. You know? In the film, you know, when you were talking with Josh, I think you told him that you feel overwhelmed sometimes. Like, how do you deal with that? Because obviously you have your nice home and all that, but how do you deal with that kind of feeling?
I try to organize and compartmentalize each. I think, well, what are the elements that are conspiring to bother me here? So if it gets really bad, I'll sit down and write an essay. I'll say, here's what I feel I'm involved in and what's bothering me about it, why it looks so, it looks so insoluble. And I'll just pack that away and refer to it a couple weeks later. Hey, it wasn't really that bad. You know, I got through, so that's part of it. Qigong helps a lot. I do, you know, Qigong, it's also called. I do a kind of a set of exercises I learned from a Tai Chi master. And I don't do them as much when I'm working hard, which is unfortunately a lot lately. But I'm lucky to have work. So I do that, and that generally makes me feel more fit and calm, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's pretty much it, you know. Just try to grapple with the details, you know, and not expect. The worst is when you expect an instant solution, you're not going to get one.
Yeah, it sounds like you've sort of gotten a hold of the agitation or whatever maybe the feeling was you had years ago.
That's true. Yeah.
I have just a couple quick questions left that are just kind of, like, one's just kind of silly.
Okay.
One is in the film, you talked about radio execs insisting that you sing Leonard Cohen. Like, I was just wondering what other sort of insane requests you've gotten like that.
It was an exec at Virgin America. The guy in charge at the time, I don't want to name names.
Sure.
But he was the big kahuna. And I don't hear, there's no damn hit on your album. You know? Now, if you would record, you know, and I got to know Leonard later. He's a great guy. And
yeah.
Really great talent. But this was not the song. This was neither the song that he made his spurs on nor the song for me. You know? so that didn't happen. You know, we had a showdown and I finally said, just give me some money and I'll record Louie Louie instead and leave me alone. You know? And they did all right with Louie Louie. They had a moderate, you know, they got some mileage out of that. So
yeah. Are there other kind of insane requests you've gotten like that? There's stuff that just wasn't right for you?
Well, there's a lot of it, and sometimes you have to do one, you know? Sometimes you have to do one. There was a very funny one. When I first came to Virgin, there was a song for the film called Black Rain, and it was called Living on the Edge of the Night, and it had been written by the sound engineer. And the director, Ridley Scott, really liked it, and they wanted me. Virgin said, well, Iggy Pop could record this for you. And then I said, well, I don't really feel that song and think it was right for me. And he gave me a call and said, come on, you know, give it a go. And I said, well, all right, I'll try it. And we went into the studio and he attended the session and I did my best. But he already had Greg Allman on the soundtrack. And he kept going to the talkback button and say, you must sound more working class, more working class. and I thought to myself, he's just going to end up using Greg all. You know, Greg is working class, you know. Greg's got that vibe. That's not me, you know. So I did the song, and, you know, it didn't ruin my life, and he ended up he was looking for something to open the film. He ended up using Greg because Greg is great. Greg is Greg, man. You know?
Of course.
So that was funny. Yeah, stuff comes up, and at one point between Funhouse and Raw Power, there was some sort of proposal that made me into a teen idol or a boy band going around. that would have been the weirdest boy band in world history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can't even imagine what that would have sounded like.
I don't know. You know, the original Stooges record, I think, honestly, if video had existed as a commercial TV outlet at that time, the Stooges probably would have gotten a lot of exposure because we had a nice visual, and it wasn't too nuts until later. When we first started, we actually looked pretty spiffy, and I could front, and the songs were simple but carefully done. I think there would have been a larger audience for it than what it got, but that's worked out anyway because of the internet, you know.
The last thing I was going to ask is just there's one lyric on the album that stands out to me every time I listen to it, and it's the "I'm nothing but my name." Do you really feel that way?
Well, yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. Sure. Don't ask me what it means. Okay. but I do. That's why it came out. Just kind of know why I feel that. But that's what I feel. It may have something to do with the game I'm in or the position that game confers upon you. I don't know.
Do you feel like you're done with rock records? I think you've made some statements sort of to that reference, to that point.
Well, it was more that I'm just, I doubted about the time I got halfway through this record. I just said, you know, I said to Josh, you know, this is going to be my last LP. I just felt like I'd done a lot of LPs. I'd done them indie. I'd done them self. I'd done them where they were bootlegged first and later legitimized. I did them for me. I did them for the man. and after a while, okay, I've done them, lots of them. And also, I noticed when the internet started becoming more important, mm-hmm. and different outlets for people to hear the music became available, I noticed that they weren't quite as reviled and poo-pooed as some of them had been. And then the ones that were considered just kind of okay, people started going, well, wait, actually, this is something. And that continues. And so part of it is I have this instinct to just get the fuck out of the way of my own stuff. Just let it sit in for a while, you know? Do I really need to sit around scratching my head? I need to make a statement. Well, no. You know, but if I'm going through something personally at the time and I get one piece of music from One O Tricks Point Never and it makes me feel a certain way and nobody hassles me and lets me do what I want, and I don't have some horrible weasel who imagines that his investment allows him to pee all over me, bothering me, you know, then I can get into a mood and sing something that means something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just feeling like that sort of thing is a better outlet for me, or maybe the theater. Mm-hmm. Or the opera, mm-hmm. things like that. Even doing the radio show I do and just present other people's music.
Mm-hmm.
How about that?
Yeah.
You know? So for that reason, you know, what else can I do? A Ramones cover album? I don't know.
I don't know. That sounds pretty cool to me, but if you
feel
like it. I noticed in the film, you said something in one of your interviews, I think with Anthony Bourdain, you said that it bothers you when somebody would come up to you and say that you put out stuff that wasn't so good, but that you're good, and that you wanted to make this album that was maybe higher quality, which is kind of what, similar to what you were just saying, but like, can you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah. In other words, I would put it this way. In general, I would say that the American, especially West Coast, rock with a capital R, no roll, just rock ethic, tends to be, I would say, short on ideas, long on execution. And my favorite music often tends to be the opposite. It tends to be really long on the ideas and short on the execution. I think it was Bob Dylan who was saying the other day, well, God damn it, yeah, when I made, and he named like his greatest album that everybody, you know, what, Blonde on Blonde or whatever it is. I was trying to squeeze 25 songs onto one side, and so the, you know, the sound quality is thin, blah, blah, blah. And there is something to that sort of thing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, how should I put this? There are hardworking people in this world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who want you to work hard on what you give them to.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I would say. And so, you know, I didn't want people to think I'm just some bum who sits around and bleeds and collects a paycheck all the time. All right. So, you know, I think some of that desire has been expressed in the approach I've done to my live work for the last about 15, 20 years. I've been doing consistent, good work live, and eventually it changed the word on me, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And people who hold large events started looking for me instead of looking away in horror, you know? So, and so I wanted to bring some of that into the recorded side of things, try to put my 2 cents worth into something that was very, very carefully done, and also something in which I was challenged. And for the challenge, I needed an outside guy, and that's also where Josh came in. Mm-hmm. You know, you need somebody stubborn and opinionated to tell you, no, not that, this, you know.
Speaking of quality, one of the other things that stood out to me about this film is there's one part where I think Josh is saying that one of the shows you played, you felt like the barricade was too far away and you wouldn't be able to jump into the audience.
Yeah, it was Berlin.
Yeah, obviously you want to keep the quality up and you do that. Like, is that just, do you ever regret jumping into the audience? You're like, why do you always do that? Like, how do you, you know, it looks painful sometimes. That's why I was kind of curious. Just keeping that quality
up. I actually gave it up. I did finally slowly give it up. The last stage, I haven't done a stage dive since I played 3 nights with Metallica at a racetrack, a huge racetrack in DFA in Mexico City. And I did what was a pretty tame one, since there were so many people packed in, they couldn't possibly get, they had to catch me. I did one each night. That was in March. I turned 70 in April. And I haven't done a dive since.
So that was Corey Groh's very entertaining interview with Iggy Pop. And I did want to say that we were shocked and saddened by some news yesterday that we lost Chester Bennington. And I think Chester would have been really moved, I would imagine, to learn how much he meant to a whole generation. You know, they were a band that sometimes had a tough time with critics, but it turns out for a lot of millennials, they were really important. I mean, hasn't that struck you, Corey? It's like,
yeah,
people were really open about how much he in particular meant to them, and the emotion in his lyrics that I think older critics sometimes scoffed at turned out to have really connected to a whole generation, you know?
Right. It's when you're growing up with something, you know, that really means a lot to you. But he's like, I think I was telling you earlier, he speaks with he's saying with a vulnerability, saying very primally, and that's what really resonated with young people.
Yeah, so hopefully we'll be addressing that in more depth in a future episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. But this has been our episode today. We'll be back next week on SiriusXM's Volume, Channel 106, next week on Friday at 1 p.m. In the meantime, be sure to download us as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts and subscribe to us as a podcast. And be sure to leave us a nice review on iTunes or somewhere else if you get a chance. And we'll see you next week.